Good morning, ladies. This morning we are studying Parashat Va'etchanan. Parashat Va'etchanan begins with a prayer, or I shall say prayers in plural, that Moshe Rabbeinu pleaded with God in order to gain entry into the land of Israel. Actually, the Gemara tells us he prayed 515 prayers, but ultimately he was denied. God told Moshe, Rav Lach, enough, don't pray anymore. Al Tosef Daber Elai Od Badabar Azeh, don't continue to implore to me on this subject, you can't go into Israel. However, God answered him partially and gave Moshe the zechut to view Eretz Yisrael. He took him on top of one of the mountains and he gave him the panoramic view of Israel, which also was valuable. If you can't enter the land, even looking at the land from above also has a tremendous amount of importance and kedushah. The word Va'etchanan, incidentally, numerically equals 515. If you count up the letters, Vav, Aleph, Taf is 400, for example, Chet is 8, Nun is 50. If you count up all the letters that make up the word Va'etchanan, it comes to the equivalence of 515 to allude to us of the 515 prayers that he prayed. Now, the question may be asked, so why didn't God stop him from the beginning? If God knew that he wasn't going to give Moshe access to the land, so why make him go through this rigorous exercise to pray 515 prayers? Is not an easy task. Imagine praying 515 amidot back to back. And these were not the same tefillot, I want you to know. Each tefillah was a different intention, different words. Why did God make Moshe Rabbeinu go through the burden if he knew he wasn't answering him anyway? God should have told him, Moshe, don't waste your breath. Don't even start. No matter how much you pray, you're not going in. He waits until 515 prayers later. Who knows how many hours that took. And then finally, Moshe Rabbeinu gets the answer. Moshe, stop, you're not going in. The explanation might be a very great lesson regarding tefillah. Many people pray for specific things and their prayers are not immediately answered. What happens to those unanswered prayers? Are they in vain? Are they for naught? Are they a waste of time? Was it a futile exercise? All those prayers that you didn't get results. What happens to them? Do they just dissipate? Do they just become dissolved into thin air? Hakamim tell us that that couldn't be the furthest thing from the truth. There is no such thing as a wasted tefillah, wasted prayer. Those prayers are placed in a, for lack of a better word, I'll say a storage box. And God puts them in a box, these unanswered prayers. And when the Jewish nation needs a salvation, God goes to the box and takes one of those prayers that we have stored on credit and redeems it. And the Jewish people enjoy success many times for prayers that were prayed many years ago that are in the warehouse in heaven. God has a stock, a storage house of unanswered prayers. So we learn a lesson from here that prayers maybe are not answered immediately, but eventually they will benefit. And if not you, they'll benefit somebody else in Israel. And if not somebody from your community, they'll have an international effect. You know, there can be a fellow that's praying for the refuah shelema of Abraham ben Sarah. They pray hundreds of prayers for the refuah of Abraham ben Sarah. And the Abraham ben Sarah that they were praying for doesn't make it. But there's another Abraham ben Sarah in Paris that also has an ailment. And miraculously that Abraham ben Sarai gets healed. And the family is shocked. Miracle. They weren't even praying. They weren't even doing anything to justify a healing. But because God used that prayer for somebody else. So really, there is no prayer that goes unanswered. It's just a matter of time, of where and when. So therefore, it's very valuable to know this. So whenever you open up your Tehillim books, rest assured you're doing something. And even if you're not doing something per se for yourselves, but you're doing something for someone somewhere in the world, and maybe even in the future generations. I heard from my rabbis several times that the European Jews that were considered very pious in one generation, they were the great scholars and the Rashi Yeshivot and the Talmudists of the time, many of their children and their immediate descendants became subject to the communists. They ended up living in communist Russia, which we know was an atheistic government. They did not believe in God. And a lot of the children of these great Hachamim became godless people. People that had no fear and no religion. And you can imagine how much pain that caused their parents. And they prayed and they prayed and they prayed that these children should come back to the fold. But a lot of those children died in their irreligious beliefs. But amazingly so, the grandchildren of those people that prayed somehow made it back to Judaism. And it's from the grandchildren of these people that we see Torah today and religion flourishing. Those prayers were not wasted. They might not have been fruitful for their children, but it affected their grandchildren. And therefore you have to know that. That whenever you pray, you are accomplishing something. You're achieving something. Never should you close the Tehillim book and say, well, it didn't work, the patient died. Well, I didn't get my request. Doesn't work that way. The prayer is filed, it's in a cabinet, and God will take that prayer out when it's necessary, in God's eyes, to use it. So you have a credit. So you deposit it, it's like, God forbid, the blood bank, Klavdil. You know, you never want to have to use the blood bank, but you donate blood, so it's in the blood bank. So if anybody ever needs blood, they have a storage. So there's a tefillah bank as well, that you're donating a prayer to the bank. Sometimes you get to take it for yourself. You're able to deposit it and withdraw it for yourself. But other times it's just a voluntary donation, and it's a service that you do for our people. And that's what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu. God said, we need 515 prayers of Moshe Rabbeinu in the bank of prayers. So I'm not going to stop him immediately. Let him pray 515 prayers. So I can have those for storage. Because Am Yisrael, in the next 3,000 years, God saw all the trials and the tribulations and the travails that the Jewish people are going to go through. He saw the catastrophes and all the troubles that are going to beset our nation. And God said, only a prayer of the true leader of Israel, Moshe, will be able to redeem them and save them from their issues. And therefore, was Moshe Rabbeinu answered? He definitely was. He just wasn't answered in the present for his personal plea. But who knows, if we're not living today in exile, and Baruch Hashem, we're enjoying all the amenities and luxuries and comforts, who knows if that's not from the prayers that Moshe Rabbeinu prayed 3,000 years ago. Hence, Moshe Rabbeinu's prayers, as well as all of ours, are always deemed necessary and always deemed important. There are many words in the Hebrew language to define prayer. Tefillah is the most famous. Tzaka would be one. That means to cry out to God. Vayit Hanan is yet another. Each word implies a different implication on prayer. Last week we talked about prayer in depth. Today I'd like to make another point of the word va'ithanan. When is that word used? Rashi tells us it comes from the Hebrew word hinam. Hinam means free. No charge. Hinam. Why was that word used here? Rashi tells us because Moshe Rabbeinu was asking God to answer him, not because of any good merits that he had. And believe me, Moshe Rabbeinu had enough good merits that he could cash them in for any reward. When you talk about his miles that he had enough miles to cash in, to ask for whatever he wants. His mitzvot were in great quantity. But Moshe Rabbeinu said, God, I'm not asking to cash in any of my mitzvot. Do it for free. Do it for free. Do it just because I'm praying. Va'ithanan, hinam. Do it because your servant is coming and asking his father for something. Don't charge me for it. And the rabbis teach us a great lesson, a very comforting lesson from this. Somebody asked me last week after the class, Rabbi, I don't feel I'm deserving that my prayers should be answered. I said, why? Because I'm not the most observant. I don't have so many zechuyot. I don't have so much merit. Why should God answer me? I'm not the most pious. And today I give the answer. Moshe Rabbeinu is teaching us that prayer and acceptance of prayer is not necessarily dependent on zechut. Anybody can pray to God because God answers us for free. Not because we have to cash in a chip and say, because I did this mitzvah, I want you to do this for me. God answers like a father answers his child. When a child begs his father, please daddy, I need this, I want this. Does the father say, well, I'll make you a deal. Give me a pair of shoes and I'll give you. He doesn't make a deal with his child. And if the child attempts to pay, the father says, keep it, I'm doing it for you for free. That's the way God deals with his children. And therefore, nobody should feel insignificant that they shouldn't be able to pray to God. And nobody should think that they're not pious enough that their prayers cannot be answered. God answers the prayers of sincere people to the extent the rabbi called the Ben Ubahaya writes in his book, Chovot HaLevavot, that even a thief, before he's about to rob a house, what does he do? He takes out his Tehillim book. Please God, save me that I shouldn't get caught. That it should be a successful heist. And if this is a sincere prayer, God might even answer the Ganav's prayer as well. And therefore you see, it has nothing to do with merit. And therefore, even if we're not totally observant in the 613 mitzvot, who's totally observant? Who can say that they haven't transgressed anything? Moshe Rabbeinu is teaching us a lesson. Va'ithanan. Ask God to do it for free. And in the zichut that we ask God, that merit alone is enough to be answered. Everybody is worthy of prayer, and everybody is worthy that their prayers may be answered. That's why the Torah uses this word. You don't necessarily need to have merit to get answered. God tells Moshe, after he finishes all the tefillot, God says to him, Rav Lach, enough. Enough, Moshe, enough. And the rabbis in the Gemara question, why did God use those words, Rav Lach, enough? And the Gemara says this was actually a case of midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Because Moshe Rabbeinu used these words himself against others. So God now used those words against him. Where were those words used? You can remember way back in the beginning of the summer we studied Parashat Korach. We learned about Korach, who was a rebel, and he took 250 men with him, in a mutinous rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu. And what was Korach's claim? Korach was a Levi. He claimed to Moshe, I want to be a Kohen. I want to dress like Aharon in the 8 special garments. I want to walk into the Holy of Holies like Aharon. And Moshe Rabbeinu told Korach and his followers, Rav Lachem, enough. Be happy that you're a Levi. Be happy that you were chosen to carry the Mishkan. The Leviim family were in charge of carrying the portable tabernacle. When the Jews traveled, it was the Levi family that was able to carry the holy vessels. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, all right, you're not a Kohen, but be happy, be satisfied. Rav Lachem, you have enough. Well, it's not good enough for you to be a Levi. You have special entitlements that most people don't have. So what are you complaining that you're not a Kohen? Rav Lachem, enough. So God says, ah, Moshe, you told Korach enough? Rav Lachem. So God tells Moshe later on, Rav Lach, enough. And the explanation is, what was that criminal with Moshe Rabbeinu told Korach? Korach was coming to usurp the throne of Moshe. What should have Moshe have done? Shouldn't he have told Korach enough? Korach, stop arguing. Why should he be, so to speak, chastised by God? You use the same word, Rav Lachem, we're going to tell you, Moshe, Rav Lach, enough. And the explanation is as follows. Of course, Korach was 100% wrong and Moshe was 100% right. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu had to quell the argument. That wasn't the claim against Moshe. But you know something, ladies? Tzaddikim are measured and judged with a very, very fine tooth comb. They're judged meticulously. The pure are judged for every single word and every single nuance. Hacham Baruch Alav HaShalom used to explain it to us in the yeshiva. It's like a fellow that's wearing a white suit. He's all white. Even the smallest stain is magnified. If a person is dressed in black, so he can have stains all over him, you don't notice them. But Tzaddik was lily white, a little stain on his neshama already becomes a big to-do. There was a claim against Moshe. Not that he stopped Korach, but the words that he used. What was the matter with the words that he used? He told Korach enough, be happy being a Levi. After all, what was Korach coming? Korach was saying, I want to be a Kohen. I want to be more religious. I want to wear the clothes of the Kohen. I want to go into the places that the Kohen can go. I want to receive transmission from God like the Kohen. He was asking for spiritual growth. You know what Moshe Rabbeinu should have answered him? Korach, very noble what you're saying. Very, very nice. But you know what? It's not your time for that. Go back home. If God wanted you to be the Kohen, God would have made you the Kohen. But you know what? I'm very proud of what you said, that you want to get more religious and you want to be higher. Great idea, but it's not your time yet. Go home, Korach. Instead, Moshe Rabbeinu used the words to Korach, be happy, enough. And we're never supposed to tell a Jew, enough. We're never supposed to tell somebody that's trying to elevate himself to new levels, Rav Lach. Be happy with the level that you're on. One is never supposed to be complacent or satisfied with his religious development. In Judaism, we must strive every day to reach new heights and new plateaus. To never feel satisfied and comfortable. As many people say, I'm good. You're never supposed to feel good. I don't mean you're not supposed to feel good, but I mean you're not supposed to feel satisfied at the level that you're on where you remain there. Moshe Rabbeinu's language was criticized by God. Why do you tell them Rav Lachem? So what does God do many years later when Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to enter Israel? Why do you think he wanted to enter Israel? So he can have falafel sandwiches on Ben Yehuda Street? Or then he can go climbing Masada or doing all the other tourist sites? Snorkeling or kayaking? What did Moshe Rabbeinu want to go to Israel for? The Gemara says he only had one intent. He wanted to go to Israel in order to fulfill the mitzvot that can only be done in the land of Israel. There are certain mitzvot that can only be done in Israel. The law of Shemitah, the law of Terumot, Ma'asrot. So Moshe pleads with God, I want to do more mitzvot. God already wasn't letting Moshe in regardless, but God said, you know what, I'm going to teach Moshe a lesson. What does he tell Moshe? Rav lach. Moshe, be happy. You did a lot of mitzvot in your life. Moshe, be happy with the level that you're on. God was chastising Moshe. You were right with Korah, but you used the wrong words. You never tell a Jew you have enough religion. So God came back, those words came back to bite Moshe. When God told Moshe, oh, you want to do more mitzvot? Oh, be happy, Moshe, you're a very rich man, you have a lot of mitzvot. Enough! Be satisfied. I heard many times from my rabbis, in the name of Rabbi Davis, alav shalom. And I heard it from Rabbi Davis himself, when he used to come to the yeshiva to talk to us. And he would always tell us, boys, don't be a pickle. At the time we were very perplexed. Never heard a rabbi warn us not to be a pickle. Rabbis warned us of many things. Don't be a pickle. What does that mean? And he explained. He said, you take a cucumber and you put it in vinegar. And you close it. And that pickle remains preserved forever. It doesn't change. It stagnates. And that pickle can remain like that for the next 100 years. Unfortunately, that's what happens to many people in their religious careers. They pickle themselves. They fall into a certain pattern, and that becomes their level, and that becomes their way, and finished. They're not interested in more. They're not interested in less either. But unfortunately in life, if one does not progress, usually he regresses. That's the nature of religion. Because there's forces against us. The materialistic world has a certain magnetism and a certain gravity that if we're not forging ahead in religion, automatically the other side draws us in and we fall. One rabbi compared this world to a down escalator. When he said, on a down escalator, if you're not walking up, you automatically go down. It's like a helicopter. If it doesn't continue to propel itself, it loses altitude. It can't shut the propellers and maintain the altitude. Automatically it's going to fall. In religion, one must continue moving and striving and growing and propelling himself to next levels. And you should never be complacent or satisfied. And that's what the rabbi meant, boys, don't be a pickle. Don't pickle yourself at one level, resisting any change. And we're all like that. We reach a certain comfort level in life. We're happy. We have a certain dosage of religion, where it satisfies our conscience, and we're able to be considered, you know, acceptable. We're happy. We found that equilibrium that doesn't disrupt any of our worlds that we live in. But the Torah is telling you over here, for Moshe Rabbeinu even to tell Korach Rav Lachem, he was told back by God, Moshe, you don't tell Jews that. Rav Lach, that was a chastisement. You want to do more mitzvot? Be happy, Moshe. What God was saying to Moshe is, a Jew can never be happy on his level. Proud of your level, yes. Should you feel good that you reached a certain level in Judaism? You must feel great about it. But that good feeling should not lull you into a stagnation. That good feeling must be an inspiration to continuously moving to greater heights. So that then goes on and tells us a mitzvah that we have in the Torah. The Pasuk writes, and I quote, now Israel, listen to the statutes and ordinances which I teach you. Do not add to that which I command you, nor diminish from it. One of the mitzvot in the Torah is, you are not allowed to add to the mitzvot, Nor are we allowed to take away or diminish from the mitzvot, to subtract from them. Meaning, there are 613 mitzvot in the Torah. We call them the teriyag mitzvot. There are 365 negative mitzvot and 248 positive mitzvot. The Torah tells us we are not allowed to add or subtract. Now, I understand why you can't subtract. Of course, if the Torah says 613 and 612, you're taking away from God's law. But what would be so bad to add some mitzvot? Isn't more better? I want to be more religious. Instead of 613, I'll add a few more. I'll have 615 mitzvot. Why would the Torah be against adding to the mitzvot? One explanation was said by the great Magid Miduvna, and he gave one of his inimitable Bisharim, and he explained in a parable. He says there was once a poor man, and he was marrying his daughter. And the father of the groom said to his consuegro, to the father of the bride, all we're asking you to provide for my son is two suits. Two suits of clothes, that's it. He knew his financial status, that he wasn't capable of more. He said, all we're asking is for two suits, that's all we want. So the poor man says, but let's say I want to make you three suits. No, don't make me three suits. Two suits is fine. But I want to make you three suits. Please, don't make me three suits. Two suits is sufficient. So he finds, why can't I make you three suits? I can't tell. Just make me two suits. When he walked away, his son said, Dad, why don't you let him make me three suits? He says, he's a poor man. The more suits he makes, the cheaper the suit's going to be. He can't afford it. At least if he makes two suits, they'll be of quality. But the more he does, the less they're going to be. They'll be inferior. God manufactured us. He knows what we're capable of doing, what we're not capable of doing. He knows our strength and He knows our weakness. In God's infinite wisdom, He said, a Jew can handle 613. That's our maximum. That's our capacity. You can do 613. Once you add even one more mitzvah, it's going to take away from the rest of the mitzvot. It's going to already compromise and dilute our observance. In this case, more is less. It's like an elevator, that it says the capacity of the elevator is 1,500. And if you put 1,600 pounds, the elevator won't be able to lift. It won't be even able to lift anything. It breaks. God knows our limit. The limit is 613. So therefore, Torah says, don't add to the mitzvot, because by adding to the mitzvot, you break the whole Torah. It's not the Torah anymore. You break the system. And then we have to have trust that God that manufactured us knows what's the best for us. But if you'll allow me today to offer a new explanation to this pasuk, a novel interpretation that I said over yesterday to the boys in our daily Daf Yomi Gemara Shi'ur. I know many of you ladies are not involved in the study of the Talmud. You're involved in more important things. But please allow me to share with you one episode from the Talmud and the explanation that we offered. Many of the pages of the Talmud are filled with different remedies. If one is ailing from certain sickness or certain malady, take this herb and roast it with this type of spice and take it at this time of the day. Many of the pages of the Gemara have prescriptions for all different types of problems. I want to point out to you that many of the rabbis tell us that a lot of those prescriptions don't work today, because we don't know really how to administer them. But in the times of the Gemara, the Hachamim were experts at curing any problem that a person had. It's amazing the genius of the Hachamim. They weren't only spiritually great, but they had a mastery of all the, what to call it, the holistic medicines and all the different types of cures. So the Gemara in yesterday's piece discussed people that are suffering eye ailments. It's interesting, the whole page is dedicated to sicknesses that affect the eye. It's interesting. I don't go to the eye doctor that often. But yesterday, after 3 years, I went to the eye doctor. It happens to be on that day, we read a whole page of Gemara talking about sicknesses of the eye. I mentioned it to the eye doctor. He thought it was shocking. He said, so that means you're not going to be here for another 3 years until you find another page with eyes on. In any event, the Gemara there tells us of a certain eye ointment that they used to put on their eyes when they had problems. It was called kilurim. And there was a rabbi called Shmuel, and he used to make the kilurim. He used to have it. It was his patent, like. So there was a rabbi called Rav Yanai. Rav Yanai sent a message to a rabbi called Mor Ukba. Mor Ukba was the chief rabbi of his time. And he said, do me a favor, Mor Ukba, could you send me some of this kidurim of Shmuel? It seems that Rav Yanai had a problem with his eye, so he needed a prescription. So he sends to Mor Ukba, could you send me some of this kidurim? So Mor Ukba answers back very strangely. He says, listen, I'm going to send you back some kidurim just so you don't think I'm a cheapskate. I'm going to send it to you. But I have something to tell you. There's even something that's more therapeutic to the eye. Just every day when you wake up in the morning, put cold water in your eye, and that's better than all the eye ointments in the world. Just wash your eyes with cold water every morning. There's nothing more beneficial to the eyes than that. And in the evening, soak your legs and soak your hands in hot water, take a hot bath. It'll cure your eyes. End of story. Now, of course, when we study Talmud, we have to go into it in depth. And the Gemara just relating us an incident. He asked for an eye ointment, and he said, I'm going to give it to you so you don't think I'm a cheapskate, but why don't you use this? What's the Gemara talking about? There has to be depth. The Gemara doesn't just relay menial episodes of the Hachamim and their conversations. So we offer the following interpretation. The depth of this piece of Talmud. And after you hear the depth of the Talmud, you'll see why we enjoy studying Talmud every day. Because there's so many secrets and messages that are hidden in the words of the Talmud that have such practical application. From a story like this where you say, okay, what does it affect me, this story over here? Do I care that he wanted some, he made a prescription for some Visine and the guy told him, oh, okay, you know, you could just wash your eyes with cold water. So explanation is like this. In life, the most important thing for success in all fields of life, whether it's in business, whether it's in health, and even in religion, is back to basics. The basics. People in business will tell you that their businesses succeeded when it was simple. When they had a certain focus, when they had a certain target, when they kept it simple, when they started to confuse it and complicate it and add products and change, that already became too confusing for the consumer. There is something to say in keeping things on an elementary, fundamental level. In health, it's the same thing. With all the different type of dieting, and all the different types of complex ways to gain health. At the end of the day, all the dietitians will tell you the best way to maintain health is just a basic, healthy diet without any crazy concoctions or extreme, just balanced, regular, eat a little of this and eat a little of that and the other. Basics, don't do anything rash, etc. In religion, it's the same thing. There are basics of our religion. And to maintain proper level of religion, all God wants you to be is what's called a simple Jew. It's not so easy to be a simple Jew. A simple Jew just means keep the basic mitzvot, get up in the morning, wash your hands 3 times, say your morning blessings with the proper intent, keep Shabbat, eat kosher, keep family purity. These are the simple laws, just follow them. But unfortunately, many people forget the basics, and they want to get involved in the esoteric. I want to get involved in the heebie-jeebie, in the spooks. And this already they're very careful on. Serve a person an egg without salt. Oh, you didn't put salt. Can't eat the egg. But you eat in non-kosher restaurants. You worry about an egg without salt? We eat things that are not kosher. This is a kosher egg, so it does not... Oh, no, you can't have an egg without salt. It's not written in the Torah. I agree, it's a minhag. We're not supposed to have eggs without salt. God forbid, unless you're in mourning, God forbid. We know that. But that's what happens to people. They end up clinging on to the peripherals of the religion, and the basics, the bread and butter of the religion, they're not following. The important priority things, no emphasis is put on it. But on the small things, pass somebody bread. You can't pass bread, so put it down. If you want to borrow an egg or borrow bread, for you have to pay for it. It's brought down in the books. But it's also brought down in the Ten Commandments, don't steal. Be honest in business. That's more important than paying a few pennies for a borrowed egg. So a lot of times in religion, we administer the things that are less important, we make. Everybody's walking around with red strings around their hand. A guy's mechalel Shabbat, he's driving on Shabbat, but he has a red string on his hand for good luck. Because it was blessed at the grave of Rachel. What are we doing? You're making from the trivials important, but the basics. It's like a person sitting down to eat. So what does he have on his plate? Ketchup, mustard, and relish. What are you eating? Dinner. What's the food? You can't just eat condiments for dinner. You can't just eat salt and pepper. You need to have something on it. When you have the foundation, then you can add some condiments and it becomes sweetened. One of the fellows in the synagogue couldn't wait to buy a second pair of tefillin. You know, there's some men that wear two pairs of tefillin every day. So this fellow couldn't wait to buy a second pair. I asked him, I said, you're so excited to wear two pairs. Could you tell me, what do you think about when you wear your first pair? He said, I don't think about anything. So what do you mean? Do you know that the halakha says that there are four basic things you must think about before you put on your tefillin every day? Not Kabbalistic, basic. A, B, C, D. But you're so involved, you want to wear two pairs. You didn't get to one pair yet. You don't even know the basics of one. But we want to be involved in Kabbalah, and that became the vogue today, the fashion. To be involved in mysticism and the magic. All these things are condiments. All these things are relish. But without the mainstay of the religion, the Tariyag Mitzvot, one fellow was careful. Every morning before prayer, he'd go to the mikveh. What a noble thing. Imagine that, to dip in the mikveh every single morning for purity. The only problem was that by the time he finished his mikveh and his shower and all that, he missed the time of praying every day. Every day he missed the time of Shema. And this is what it says, Hachamim medakdekim be'echa mezalzelim b'kriyat Shema. They're careful on echa, but when it comes to the main things of the religion, they're not careful on. It's misguided priorities. Again, going to the mikveh is noble, but to what extent, to what level, to what sacrifice? We must administer the basics of religion. Saying our berachot with kavanah. There was one fellow we talked about praying at sunrise. How important is it? Last week we talked about praying with the sun. There's one person so careful, he bought his atomic clock, he got the time from the United States military where it gives you the longitude and latitude, so you know exactly to the nanosecond what time sunrise is. And 5:27 and 32 seconds, boom, he starts his Amidah. Oh, he's a righteous man. Ask the fellow, did you have Kavanah in the first Berachah and the Amidah? I don't have Kavanah, but I prayed at sunrise. According to my mind, if you don't have intent in the first berakha of the Amidah, your Amidah doesn't count. But he's so careful to pray with the sun. That's what happens to us. We got involved in so much of the extras that we're neglecting the meat and potatoes of the religion. We're neglecting the ikar. It's like the fellow that built a home. He built a home, And in his living room and dining room, he turned it into a pool hall. Put a big pool table in his living room and dining room. So I said, where are you going to eat? Oh, I didn't think about that. Well, we have a pool table here. Where are we going to put one? I didn't think of that when I built the home. You fool? When you build a home, you have to build the primary rooms. After you build the primary rooms, you want to build a small little extension to put a game room. That's another story. But when you build a game room to the exclusion of your living quarters, the same thing in religion. You have to know how to administer it properly. And maybe that's what the Gemara was saying. The rabbi sent to Mor Ogba, I want kilurin, I want this complex eye ointment. What he was saying is, Rabbi, you're the chief rabbi of the generation. Give me some of the secrets. Give me some of the extras. Give me some of the, some of the nuances of the religion. And the rabbi said, I'm going to give you them just so you don't think that I'm holding back anything from you. But let me tell you a secret in religion. Basics. Wash your eyes every morning with cold water. That's better than all the kilurin in the world. But he was telling him, just pray every morning, be a decent Jew, follow the mitzvot as prescribed. It's like there was a rabbi called Rabbi Weissmandel. He was in Yemen for one Sukkot. The holiday of Sukkot, he found himself in Yemen. And right before the holiday, ahead of Sukkot, he saw a very strange minhag. One of the Yemenite Jews walks into the synagogue with a crate of etrogim. And he places the etrogim on the teba. And everybody goes and grabs one and throws a couple of, coins in the tzedakah box. And that's how they bought the etrogim. The Weissmandel says, I don't believe it. Back at home, we make a big thing of buying an etrog. We investigate, we check, we look, we get a second opinion, we compare, we pay hundreds of dollars. And these guys, they come in 5 minutes, each guy grabs an etrog, puts a couple of pennies in the thing and walks out. What kind of people are these over here? He was a little upset. Then the next day came. And now the Hazan gets up to Hazan by the Teba to be the Shaliach Shibur. And all of a sudden one of the people get up and say, I'm sorry, this man is not qualified to be the Hazan today, for yesterday he told a lie. And the community got up and said, this is correct. And the Hazan said, yes, it's true, I lied yesterday. And he sat down. He said, I don't believe it. Look how meticulous these people are about lying. Look how careful they won't let Hazan get up if he lied the day before. So Rabbi Weissmandel said, everybody's careful on things. It depends what they're careful on. He says, we're back home, we're careful about an etrog. But when it comes to lying, that's not so important. They're more careful about inspecting character than an etrog. And they're right. Because lying is written in the books, lying is written in the Torah, not the Shakeru. And therefore, they're priorities are much better than ours. Yeah, it's nice to inspect an etrog for 2 hours to make sure it doesn't have any blemishes. But not if you're going to cheat and lie and be dishonest. So then already you just took the perks of the religion. You took the items, you took the extras. But you left the main things. And that's what the rabbi was telling him. I'm going to give you the eye ointment. But you know what? You don't need the complex stuff. Go back to the regular things. Wash your eyes every morning with cold water. That's better than any complexity in the world. And that's the same thing in religion. Basics, ladies. Basics. Don't confuse yourself with all different type of... like I said, things that are not of the essence. Now, I'm not, chas v'shalom, mistreating these customs. They're important, they're all important, but they're only important when you have a basis. But if there's no basis, then these things have little value. And that's what the pasuk is telling over here. Lo tosifu, don't add to the mitzvot. Meaning some people, they neglect the mitzvah and they only add, they're only involved in the additions. The two tefillins, the mikveh, that's an addition, but if you don't have the mitzvah itself, your addition is worthless. Don't add to the mitzvah. Make sure you do the mitzvah itself. Recently there's been an episode in our community, which I found out about it when it happened. But now it seems it reached the newspapers. When there's a big cry against anti-Semitism, that a fellow can go to a restaurant and given on his bill it says Jew couple. Oh, what a terrible, terrible thing that a Jew has become a victim of anti-Semitism. But where does he become a victim of anti-Semitism? In a Taref restaurant. Are we not ashamed? This is more shameful than any anti-Semitism. That a guy calls us Jew couples in a Taref restaurant. Of course, what are we doing in his restaurant? We don't belong there. We shouldn't be there in the first place. To come and cry anti-Semitism. But what are we doing? What about the shame that we're giving to God? God says we don't belong there. That's not humiliating God's law. We're too concerned about our own kavod. They called me a Jew couple. But what are you doing? You're humiliating God's law now in a newspaper, as if Jews have a right to be in these places and we have a right to demand respect in these places. We shouldn't be there in the first place. We have no right to demand anything in those places. In a Jewish restaurant, there is no anti-Semitism in a kosher restaurant. But again, we left the essence. Revolved. Oh, he called me a Jew. But leave that, the essence. You're not in a kosher place. Leave that point. I'm worried about the anti-Semitism. We become so demented and warped in our priorities. That's less important. And this is more important. God's law is superseded by such things. I'm not condoning biased attacks, ladies, on any account. Chas v'shalom. But when and where? That should be more painful to us. The fact that there's no shame, that people can publicly announce to the world that Jews have no care of their religion. To publicly announce that we go eat in Taref restaurants. And not only that, but we demand respect all of a sudden in their restaurant. We want to be treated as equals. But the Torah tells us, you're not equals. You don't belong there. How dare we now demand from the public to be equals on their ground? That was a message from God. Jew couple, you don't belong here. You're Jewish. There's no Ashkenazi in this place. Go somewhere else. That was an angel that gave them that message. And instead they missed the message. The message now becomes biased attack against Jews. You'll forgive me. But I don't believe we have a right to claim that under those circumstances. Our priorities have become skewed. And that's what Torah is telling us. Lo tosifu. Don't add. Don't make your own law. Follow the law as prescribed by the Torah. If a doctor gives you a prescription, and you come along now and decide you're going to take your own dosage of it. In all odds, God forbid, you're going to get sicker and not better. God says, trust me, this is the prescription. Just follow it as I said. Don't make from the extras emphasis and from the important things the emphasis. Lo tosifu ala davar. Kilurin is nice. That complex eye ointment is very good. But it has to be taken only after you have the simple things. I once saw somebody go to a great rabbi in our community. They were having a conversation. And the rabbi greeted this layman by saying, Hachem Yosef, good to see you. So the layman says, Hachem Yosef, I'm not Hachem Yosef. I'm a simple Jew. So the rabbi responded, simple Jew? All my life I'm striving to be a simple Jew. Don't think that's such an easy thing. Simplicity is very difficult. We forgot how to become regular observant Jews, just fulfilling the regular mitzvot like they were prescribed. We're looking for the angle. We're looking for the magic, you know, for the shortcut, for the secret, for the magic water, for all the things that are brought down. But all these customs, one rabbi said it the best when he said, it's a shame don't steal isn't a custom. It's a shame that don't steal is one of the Ten Commandments. Because if it was a custom, then everybody would keep it. If it was a custom, you have to keep the custom. When we give more priority to minhagim, which are all important, don't get me wrong, all our customs are important, they're all holy, they must be observed. But, as I said, driving on Shabbat with the red strings, what are you doing? Claiming anti-Semitism in a tariff restaurant, what are you doing? Wearing three pair of tefillin when you don't even know how to respect one. And going to the mikveh every day where you're missing the time of Shema. Keep the basics. Pray on time. Eat kosher. Family purity. Be decent to your friends. The reformed Jews and the conservatives, they came along and they capitulated the entire Torah into one mitzvah. Have a good heart. Finished. Cardiac Jews. One mitzvah. Be nice. Be nice. Say good morning to everybody. Smile. Be polite. Then we have 613 mitzvot. What about all that? Then leave all those. You think God cares about all these other technicalities? Just be a good guy. They came along and they took a prescription this big and they shortened the prescription into one mitzvah. And look where it got them. Once already you take the Torah and you shrink it, it's not a Torah anymore. And now already look at the assimilation and the intermarriage that it caused them. As long as the Torah is complete with 613, it's a fence. It's not missing any bricks. Once already you take a brick off, now there's a hole in the fence. Now already we're subject to assimilation and troubles. Hence the Torah says don't diminish either. And that's a very important lesson that we may learn, ladies, as well. Back to basics. You go to classes and you study. Don't overemphasize mitzvot that the Torah doesn't overemphasize. I'll give you one example. Even the administering of mitzvot, some mitzvot are more important than others. But you have Jews that have their opinions. I think that this mitzvah is more important. It's not for us to think. The Torah tells us what's more important. There was one fellow, he went to a wedding. So he saw the hatan. And he looked at the bride. And he says, wow. He says, I gotta give you a lot of credit. What do you see in her? So the guy's taken aback. He says, what? He says, you'll forgive me, but I'm very candid. That's my nature. I'm just honest. That's my nature. I just tell the truth. You think the Torah wants you to be honest in that situation? So he took a mitzvah and he went extreme with it. But the Torah tells you in that case you're supposed to lie. You're supposed to say, what a beautiful wife. You're lucky. She's beautiful. Now, he became George Washington all of a sudden. Never tell a lie. So he took a mitzvah and he overemphasized it. The Torah says, lo tosifu. You're not allowed to overemphasize mitzvot either. You have to administer them according to the Torah's level. And when you know how to administer it, the Talmud will tell you. When you have two mitzvot, Shabbat and human life, what overrides what? Shabbat is very important, but human life is even more important. So you have a fellow living in a religious neighborhood, and the doctors tell him, you must go to the hospital. He says, oh no, I've been keeping Shabbat for 80 years. I'm not getting in a car now and ruining my streak. That man is guilty of suicide. But what do you mean? Shabbat! Yeah, but the Torah tells you in this case you do not keep Shabbat. Human life is more important. So you see, you're not allowed to add to the mitzvot according to your feeling. Because you feel that this mitzvah is more important, so you're going to take an extra dosage of it. Not to sifu. Follow it according to the Torah's prescription. One of the settlers that we talked about last week, the residents, the terrible disengagement that we're witnessing. So a lady this week, as they were taking her out of her home, she set herself on fire. She's critically now in the hospital. I ask you, it's a mitzvah to live in Israel. It's a mitzvah to settle the land. But to what extent? To the extent where now you're going to burn yourself because of this? We're all upset what's happening. We're all crying, we're all losing sleep watching the images. But to what extent now? So do you burn yourself for this? Or do you raise your hand against another Jew because of this now? Everything has to be measured according to its priority. We don't make from one mitzvah an ism. We don't make from one mitzvah a worship of one mitzvah. Every mitzvah has its importance and they all must be kept. And let that be a lesson to us ladies. And then when we start following the religion according to its prescription, then already we have success. And it takes time for us to get the proper diet exactly, how to balance all the 613 mitzvot. That's why you need a rabbi. That's why you need a rabbi to guide you. Do this, don't do this. This is more important, do not do that. Because when we start to take our own medicine, write our own prescriptions, usually we fail. You need to go to a professional who knows it from the books, not from his own brain, from the books. That's why the Mishnah says, Aseh Lecharav. And today you learned that mitzvah lo tosifu, don't add. Don't add means two things today. Number one, don't get involved in the extras before you get involved in the basics. And number two, don't add emphasis on a mitzvah if the Torah did not give it that emphasis. And then, Be'ezrat Hashem, the Torah will protect us. It will protect our families. It will protect our children and our community. And Be'ezrat Hashem, the Torah will save us from assimilation and anti-Semitism. And then, Be'ezrat Hashem, Yisrael, Yishkon Nabeta, will be secure in our borders.